and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza. This program is recorded via remote, and here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 5th, 2020. A new UN panel of experts report says South Sudan peace partners are busy recruiting soldiers.
We don't recruit youth, the underages.
And a game of seek and hide continues in Lake State between South Sudan Army and armed cattle keepers.
The reality, somebody who abandoned school and went to cattle camp and begin to involve with this intercommunal violence, I don't consider that person as intellectual.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN panel of experts on South Sudan says the 2018 peace deal is at risk because the peace partners are competing over security control and resources. The panel said in a report released last week that signatories to the peace agreement have failed to meet security arrangement deadlines. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
In the 60-page document, the panel wrote that both the former transitional government and the opposition are forcefully recruiting civilians, including children, to boost the size of their forces to include in cantonment sites. The UN experts said the army and SPLA-IO carried out forced recruitment of children as young as 12 years old in Koch, Panyinjar, and Rupkona. As a result, many children and young people who were recruited have not been transiting between the Bentiu protection of civilian site and Darbour, the SPLA-IO headquarters, to avoid being taken to the Moam training center. Government spokesperson Michael McQuay defended recruitment tactics.
Any unit which has shortage of personnel has the right to recruit. What are they trying to do? Are they the ones to manage the government of South Sudan? Are they the governor?
SPLA-IO official Stephen Parkwall, who is Minister for Peace Building in the transitional government, denied his group is recruiting children.
We don't recruit youth, the underages. I also read in that report that IO is still occupying civilian centers. That is also wrong, because there was a time when the government occupied 24 locations and civilian centers, and we were occupying only one. We evacuated a long time.
Lamakola Jawin, a member of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, says there have been new recruits in training centers, which he called wrong and a violation of the agreement.
So where these fresh soldiers come from? They were even lactating women in the training centers, you know. We are not saying that the woman should be part of the force, but you cannot have a lactating woman in the training center, because first of all, the training center is really exhausting.
According to the UN panel of experts, the parties have slightly more than 45,000 forces, just over half of the full force size of 83,000 as is specified in the agreement. The panel also says many SSPDF and SPLA-IO commanders have instructed their forces to remain outside of the security reunification process, to hold on to their weapons and stand ready to re-engage in active fighting, something the panel says creates doubt about the reintegration of forces. Both McQuay and Kwall deny the panel's findings. Again, the SPLA-IO's Stephen Kwall.
This allegation that some of our generals are holding back the forces, that is not true. The main problem has been the fact that we don't have the necessities that are needed, you know, to have a cantonment, a functioning cantonment, like food, shelter, medicine, and the rest. We are not holding back the forces, but you must have a functioning cantonment site with all the necessities for human life there.
Right.
And that's the major problem now.
When asked about bickering over economic resources, Akol says that was caused by delays from both sides to implement security arrangements and form state governments.
We have said from the beginning as well that any transitional arrangement that is made or based on the power sharing will not deliver the reform that is required. Because when you talk of power sharing, that each party will be busy trying to get the maximum in terms of resources and also in terms of control. And control is in security sector.
In the April 28th document, the panel of experts also said the National Security Service has expanded its unchecked security control to silence political and civic dissident. It says national security agents continue to arbitrarily arrest and detain civilians at a prison facility called Riverside and commit serious human rights violations. The panel also said President Salva Kiir shows no intention of restraining the agents' unchecked powers. Makwei disputes that allegation.
It is not enough to say it is arresting people arbitrarily. You say they arrested X, Y, Z. You don't just say they have been arresting people arbitrarily, they have been doing this. All these stories are old stories.
The panel says it verified up to 40 detainees at the Riverside facility who have not been charged with a crime. The panel also said both sides committed abuses against civilians in Central Equatoria, an accusation denied by Makwei and Kwol. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Some residents of the Lake State capital, Rumbek, say they are living in fear after an increased number of armed cattle keepers in urban areas. The residents say they worry the cattle keepers will carry out revenge killings. Authorities in Lake State say they have dispatched a police unit in hot spots to keep peace. For VOA News, William Sande Mabor reports from Lake State.
Some residents of Lake State, capital Rumbek, says insecurity has been rampant in several rural parts of Lake State, where several intercommunal attacks and counterattacks have left hundreds of people dead over the past year. Last week, armed youth killed one civilian and a police officer in Rumbek. Rumbek resident Ben McCoy says seeing so many armed youth roaming around residential areas scares him. McCoy says whenever youth from different communities fight in rural areas, some of them extend the fighting to the town with intent to kill people who have nothing to do with the cattle camps.
When you look at these armed youth, our village here around Rumbek town, particularly Lakes State, they use our arm. After their own clutches, reach up to the town, just killing some intellectuals. Like one of our intellectuals that was he was killed in his residential at his house some few days ago, and this one can let us feel it insecure.
Rumbek resident Benjamin Makur Mabor says some young people who engage in intercommunal fight are school drops out. He says whenever such youths are killed in the fighting, the relatives claim that their educated relative has been killed and vow to carry out a revenge killing on any educated person from a rival community.
The reality is somebody who abandoned school and went to cattle camp and begin to involve in this intercommunal violence, I don't consider that person as intellectual. Okay. And so coming to town and target somebody who is focused doing things in town, who is actually employed and doing different things altogether, is not something acceptable.
Makur says the only way to end intercommunal violence in Lagos State is to disarm the youth.
I believe if government comes in and disarm the youth, even this target killing of intellectual would immediately cease. And we hopefully know the government is also making an attempt, like those suspects who are involved in target killing are being identified, some are being apprehended.
Lagos State authorities acknowledge the presence of armed youth in the state capital is causing panic among residents. Martin Machej, the Secretary General for the now defunct Western Lake State and Administrator of Lake State, says he has deployed security forces, including police, National Security Service, to residential areas to protect civilians.
There will be stable security because some people were trying to kill others, youth, just around the town. But now we had deployed forces around the town, key places around the town to protect those who are coming in and going out of the town. So there is no way for any revenge killing that will happen again in the town because the town is properly protected.
My church says parents should advise their children to lay down weapons and stop looting the property of the people from their communities. He also advises civilians to collaborate with the security forces to help prevent violence and for the youth from various communities to work together to resolve intercommunal conflict. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabur reporting in Rumbek Lake State.
some Sudanese women activists in Khartoum have welcomed the move by the government to criminalize female genital mutilation, or FGM. Last week, the Sudanese transitional government approved a draft law that criminalizes FGM, making it punishable by up to 3 years in prison. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
At least 87% of the Sudanese women between the ages of 14 and 49 have undergone some form of FGM, according to the United Nations. The proposed law says anyone found guilty of performing the procedure would be sentenced to up to 3 years in prison. The draft law is expected to be introduced before the Cabinet and Sovereign Council members, who play a legislative role during the transitional period. Wafa Adam Mahmoud, who works at the local NGO SIHA, which advocates for women's rights, welcomes the move to ban female genital mutilation, noting thousands of Sudanese women are victims of the practice. Mahmoud says Sudanese women continue to face other forms of violence at home and in their communities, and wants the transitional government to reform laws that would protect women's rights in Sudan.
It is more important to think about the forced marriage or early marriage, because when we criminalize the FGM, it is important to think about the forced marriage, which is also a more serious and a protection issues for the women and girls in Sudan.
Sudanese activist Mahasin Dahab says for 30 years, Sudanese laws oppressed women, and thousands of women were victimized under those laws. She says some social traditions need to be regulated because they still violate women's rights.
It's extremely sad to know that there is no law on domestic violence. There is only the criminal law, and that's just not it. For a random stranger to actually stab you, beat you, that's the thing. That's someone I can go and sue with that law. But what about my family that actually abuses me?
Dahab says thousands of women across the country do not know their rights as citizens. She says the government of Ulster President Omar al-Bashir restricted many freedoms.
We only have a law and we don't have the conversation going on. We don't see anything about it on TV, on local news. We don't see it on, we don't listen to it on radio. And it's extremely sad.
Manal Al-Juzuli, who heads the Sudanese National Women Union, a coalition of women's groups, describes the proposed ban on FGM as historic.
This came out as a result of a long-standing struggle by a feminist movement, by initiative, by women activists, by women inside their political parties.
The UN Children's Fund, or UNICEF, issued a statement last week welcoming the criminalization of FGM in Sudan, but said passing a law will not solve the problem. Abdallah Fadil, the UNICEF country representative for Sudan, said in a statement, quote, "We need to work very hard with the communities to help enforce this law," end quote. UNICEF says it is committed to eliminating all forms of FGM in Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya introduces voluntary COVID-19 testing. But is it effective? Stay tuned for an answer to that question after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you believe in fate?
Yes, I do believe in fate. I do believe that once you have been given a particular purpose, fate will definitely make you get into it, whether you turn to the negative or the positive direction. Eventually, you get to achieve what has been planned for you.
Sometimes I do, because there are sometimes opportunities that comes unexpectedly, but sometimes I don't believe in it because everything is possible.
I don't believe in faith because I think once in life, no matter the family or your background, things can change. Your life had not been arranged in a certain way that you had to, no matter what, follow that trend.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And in our Tuesday's health segment, we take a look at how effective is voluntary tests for COVID-19. Kenya has reported 46 new coronavirus infections in the last 24 hours, the biggest single-day increase since the first case was reported in March. The country is offering voluntary free testing in densely populated risk areas. But the Ministry of Health says there has been low turnout. The testing kicked off Friday and is expected to continue this week. Rahel Ombor reports for VOA from Nairobi.
On Monday morning, 25-year-old Martin Wakwayika was one of the hundreds in Isili, a neighborhood in Nairobi's Central Business District, who turned up at a temporary Ministry of Health stand to get tested for the coronavirus. Having recorded more than 50 coronavirus cases, Isili is one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Nairobi that Kenya's Ministry of Health warned might be a coronavirus hotspot. The ministry on Friday began mass testing in the targeted areas, with hundreds of residents like Wakweyika volunteering themselves for testing. What made me go for testing, he says, is the information that there were confirmed cases here in Isili. He says, I went to get tested to know if I was okay. I have two children in the house and I'm always out working, so I had to know if I am okay. Another hotspot where dozens more positive cases were confirmed in the past week is the neighborhood of Kawangware. Hundreds queued for testing at a primary school in the area on Monday, but thousands more, such as Connie Mwana, chose to stay at home.
When you get to those quarantine facilities, the chances of contracting COVID-19 are high because of the way people are staying in the facilities. For example, sanitation is a bit low. The washrooms, people are sharing washrooms, picking individuals who taking them by force to these quarantine facilities, I think has made people fear.
Mwana says she cannot risk exposing her kids to quarantine if she was to test positive. She hopes if she has the virus, it may pass as a flu without her noticing. But thinking like that will allow the virus to spread, said Ministry official Rashid Aman at a news conference Sunday.
The outcome of the testing exercise so far has shown a low turnout in some of these areas. In the last 2 days, the testing teams have tested 803 against a target of 2,000 in Kawangware, 494 in Isli against a target of 3,000. I want to remind Kenyans that there are countries where people beg to be tested, yet their governments are unable to do so. As of now, the Ministry of Health has acquired the testing capacity to undertake targeted testing, but the willingness of the people to be tested is low.
Part of the problem may be that those who are found positive are charged for the test and have to spend 2 weeks in quarantine at a government facility. The cost of quarantine, which is also charged to the patient, is $20 per day, much more than the daily wage of most people in the slum areas where the mass tests are being conducted. In an effort to encourage more testing, the Ministry of Health on Monday said the government will cover the fees of patients who show they cannot afford the costs. On Monday, Kenya recorded 25 new cases of the coronavirus, raising the number of confirmed cases in the country to 490. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Still on health matters, health officials in South Sudan say the country does not have enough isolation facilities to keep all COVID-19 patients. A doctor in charge of the COVID-19 task force says patients who are suspected of having the disease continue to go to crowded markets to buy food. David Monodanga has more for VOA from Juba.
With two patients released on Monday who recovered from COVID-19, South Sudan now has 50 active COVID-19 cases. Only 7 out of the 50 active COVID-19 cases are at isolation facilities. The others are quarantining in their homes. Officials say police officers have been stationed around the homes of the confirmed cases to ensure they do not come in contact with the general public. Dr. Angok Gordon, incident manager for the South Sudan COVID-19 Task Force, says some COVID-19 patients find it difficult to remain in quarantine. He says his office has received reports of patients who have left designated quarantine houses.
They are mobile because they lack certain basic things in their homes. Food, water, electricity. And this will trigger some of them always to leave the house and go outside. Now, when we receive call from the communities around that these people are not staying home, immediately as incident manager, we report to law enforcement partners.
Dr. Cole says it has proven difficult to control patients who are under isolation in their homes because they want to go out and get things like water and food. He says containing these patients requires the commitment of all stakeholders, including the patients themselves.
It needs resources. It needs people who are committed. It needs good memory from the people who have been found positive. And others also are refusing to be tested. They think that it is better they are not known. Others, when we tell them that they are positive, no, they deny that I've not been sick.
Dr. Kwal says tents that were set up in preparation for the Ebola virus in Yei, Nimule, Tombora, Yambio, Maridi, and here in Juba have been converted into COVID-19 isolation facilities. He says South Sudan now has 40 beds and 7 ventilators. Dr. Kwal says he hopes the mild cases do not become severe.
We focus on the prevention, the message of prevention, which we have said many times. It is good, God is kind with us. Up to this moment, we don't need patients actually needing ventilator. But if need be, then we will have to save some of the guys who enter into that situation.
Dr. Joseph Wamala, Emergency Response Officer of the World Health Organization in South Sudan, says the coronavirus patients are being given symptomatic treatment to strengthen their immune system.
We've heard that there are many trials that are underway. I think one of those, like under WHO, is the Solidarity Trial that is trying a number of antivirals that are being used for other diseases like Ebola, HIV, but also drugs like chloroquine, hydrochloroquine that are being used for treatment of malaria. So these are still at trial stage.
Hydroxychloroquine has not been proven to cure COVID-19 patients. Dr. Wamala says COVID-19 patients are given fever-reducing medication when their fevers spike and given juice or water when they are dehydrated.
This could be chronic conditions like hypertension, heart disease, or diabetes that could predispose these people to very severe disease, or treating what we call coexisting infections. This could be infections like malaria, or TB, or the other common illnesses.
Dr. Wamala says some patients with respiratory diseases may need oxygen or ventilators. According to WHO, more than 90% of the patients in South Sudan do not present with coronavirus symptoms. But Dr. Wamala says the health ministry needs to test as many people as possible so it can curb the spread of the virus. So far, South Sudan has tested a little more than 1,200 people. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
Human Rights Watch is calling on the Chinese government to end what it calls racial discrimination against Africans and people of African origin living in China during the COVID-19 pandemic. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has denied singling out foreigners.
Early last month, Chinese authorities in the southern city of Guangzhou, which has China's largest African community, began a mandatory campaign to test Africans for the coronavirus. Landlords then evicted African residents, forcing many to sleep on the streets as hotels, shops and restaurants refused to attend to African customers. Yekyung Wang, Chinese researcher at Human Rights Watch, said that the Chinese authorities visited homes of African residents, testing them on the spot or instructing them to take a test at a hospital, a treatment that other foreign groups were not subjected to.
Chinese authorities began a campaign to forcibly test Africans for the coronavirus. Most importantly, the policy is racist and discriminatory because why are only Africans targeted? Why not other groups? I mean, this is a question that Africans right now in China who have been tested asked, why are only us? Why not everybody else if it's targeting foreigners?
Wang said most imported cases of COVID-19 to Guangzhou were Chinese nationals returning from abroad and that many Africans had already tested negative for the virus.
People who are abroad and who are going back to China who might carry the virus, most of them are Chinese nationals living abroad. Secondly, the policy completely disregard that whether the foreigners in China have any contact with people who are infected or have recent travel history.
In a statement released by the Chinese government yesterday Sunday, Chinese Foreign Ministry denied that China had been singling out foreigners. Karine Kaneza, African Advocacy Director at the Human Rights Watch, said that Chinese has denied the allegations despite the reports with evidence on social media.
The Chinese government has denied discriminating against Africans in Guangzhou, saying that, and I quote, it rejects differential treatment and has zero tolerance for discrimination. It's important to also recognize that what's been happening in Guangzhou is part of a wider pattern of racial discrimination. The fact that even before the COVID-19 pandemic erupted, the police frequently targeted Africans.
According to Human Rights Watch, about 14,000 African nationals live in Guangzhou. Reports of discrimination against Africans in China triggered anger among African communities around the world as several African governments, including Nigeria, Uganda, and Ghana, summoned Chinese ambassadors in their countries to protest. Reporting for VOS, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the Freedom Boys singing in Acholi.
Joseph Lagu, Roberto Moga, Rubanga ena ina chwechi.
We've been listening to the Freedom Boys with their song in Acholi. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to stay at home, wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Dodoma
is Africa.